There's one photo.
I'll just say where you felt that wasn't quite right.
This book.
There. Mm.
Difficult to explain why, because it was feeling much more than an intelligent judgment.
Yes.
You see, I knew Philippa up to a point well, in the sense that I worked with her for a number of years. I saw her almost daily. She clearly felt very friendly to me because she went out of her way to be nice to me. I used to talk to her about things. I had a great admiration for her mind and the clarity with which she saw things through. So my impressions, although clearly I didn't know her intimately as her family and personal friends knew her, are at least first hand.
Yes.
And reading this, I felt, now this is terribly well researched. She's got all the facts, she's inquired right, left and centre. But for me, the portrait of Philippa in it isn't the Philippa I knew. Mm. Of course, she stops when Philippa was still as a comparatively young woman, and I knew her in comparative old age.
Yes.
And people do change. And clearly the Philippa Strachey that I knew had softened a great deal in all sorts of ways, I think.
Mm. But you said, I think, on the phone, I think, last night, or the other night, that you don't really see her as a good administrator.
Oh, no. I didn't say as a good administrator. She could be a marvellous administrator on paper, because she always saw where things were going and how they were going and what would be the result of what was done. I can't see her as the practical person nursing a sick brother, which she did, but I would think she had paid nurses on the job too, or Dora Carrington did it for her. I can't see her boiling a potato or cleaning her shoes or knowing how to tidy up a house or cook a meal, because she never did those things when I knew her. She always said, I am a fool at these things, I cannot do them. And I don't think with her this was a pose, because she was not given to poses.
Yes.
With some people it is.
Yes. You know. I imagine in India there are ever so many servants rushing around.
She could organise. I mean, you know, I'm quite certain that Philippa in her younger days had enormous capacity for pointing, which pointing with us is, you know, a family phrase. We always say you must learn to point, which means you don't do everything yourself. Do this, do that, do that.
Yes, yes,
to people.
Yes, yes.
And that I'm sure she could do. In fact, she did it in her intellectual work.
But she wasn't in, I'm talking about the LSWS now, the LNSWS, I suppose I should call it. Yes. She wasn't a person who went around saying do this, do that in any dominant way.
No, not a bit. Not a bit. She gave no impression of dominance, except where people made idiotic mistakes, and then she would have them put right, and she was never nasty about it. Not to my knowledge. And I can only speak as I found her. And she was much more likely to say, but my dear, we can't have this, you know? It's impossible. It's frightful. I think it would be better if we did so and so and so and so.
Yes.
But in that sense, she would get things altered, and she was quite capable of bullying people in the most charming way. And instead of resenting it, they just liked her. She was a very lovable person, I think.
She had, in a different way, she had the same sort of quality that you described, I think, last time that Ray had. That is, of making it enjoyable to do what she wanted
it
to do.
It was fun. She, you see, her causes were fun. She enjoyed what she was doing. She had a tremendous zest, and one of the things that I remember most vividly are the annual general meetings of the old Londoner National Society, when Philippa gave the report for the year. And this report was not just a factual description of what had happened. It was, in a sense, a literary exercise by word of mouth, you know? And she would often speak and not read all of it. Part of it she would read, and then she would speak. And it was in beautiful telling phrases with the characteristic Strachey exaggeration here and there. I don't mean exaggeration what had happened, but exaggeration in her adjectives.
Yeah, yes,
with the emphasis, you see.
Mm. So they would actually, the reading out of it...
She had a colourful...
It
was entertainment. We wouldn't have missed it. I used to sit there enthralled and think, what a politician you would have made. save and except that I don't think Philippa would have made a politician, because I don't think she would ever have towed the line of a thing she didn't believe in.
Mm.
She would always have been wanting to cross the floor, whatever party she belonged to.
She's an odd person in a way, isn't she, to be so interested in women's careers, in that she'd never had a career herself? I mean, you'd think that somebody who would direct the LSWS in the career direction, which she undoubtedly did, would have herself experienced some of the disadvantages women have in competing in the land world.
I think she was a quite impassioned feminist, in the best sense of that term. Not in the sense of not liking men and having sympathy with their problems, because she obviously had, as I think you must have to be a good feminist. But she believed in the equality of the sexes. She believed in what could be done when the sexes worked together. I think she really believed, and I certainly share this belief, that when you get men and women working in enterprises on exactly equal terms, with parity of esteem, you get something infinitely better than two men working or two women working on the same thing. Because while I think there are all sorts of exceptions, and there probably isn't what is called a normal feminine point of view and a normal masculine point of view, there's every conceivable gradation between them.
Mm-hmm.
I think that in general there is a slight tendency for men not to see the trees for the wood and for women not to see the wood for the trees.
Mm.
And I think this is probably conditioning.
Yeah. Yeah.
Men for centuries have had to deal with big extraneous matters.
Mm.
Women have been housebound. They've had to have one ear cocked for the front door bell,
yeah,
another for the baby crying,
yeah,
an eye for the pan of milk boiling over on the stone. They have been concerned with trivia.
Yes, I know.
And so trivia play quite a large part in their thinking.
Yeah,
their attention to detail can blind them to bigger issues.
Mm.
Whereas I think the converse is true, that men's attention to the big issues can blind them to the individuals who are concerned.
Yes. Yes, I agree.
And so when you get the two points of view really working together, I think you get something extraordinarily good.
Of course, in the Strachey family, you had women creating entertainments,
yes,
or whatever it might have been, together.
Yes.
I mean, she,
yes,
came from,
yes,
a world where men and,
yes,
women were very much...
Though,
together.
Oddly enough, I mean, I never knew the other Strachey sisters. I didn't know Marjorie or Eleanor. I knew Pernell, and I knew Philippa. They were the only two I did know.
Mm.
And... I met Oliver Strachey once, but that's all. The only other things I know about them is what is history and
yes,
what's written about them. And so many of the Strachey men were not in any sense, normal specimens. They were odd specimens,
yes,
odd men out.
Yes. Yes.
And Lytton, I think, must have been odd in all sorts of ways other than his sexual deviations.
Mm. Mm. But anyway, your feeling is that Pippa really is an organising genius, but in an unobtrusive way behind the scenes, thinking things out rather,
yes,
than... Well, in fact, Ray does the sort of overt control for a lot of the life, doesn't she?
I think it would be very unfair, from what I know of them, and as I've said to you repeatedly, I know... in one sense, I knew them very well. In another sense, I didn't know them intimately, in that I wasn't part of their home and private life.
No.
And I think to know people really intimately, you must be. And
yes,
I wasn't.
Yes.
I think I knew both of them better than any other member of the staff did, including Margaret Baines, who was Ray's secretary, who worked with her constantly.
Yeah.
Margaret adored her. Margaret just thought she was like God. And the whole of her energies were, given over to doing things for her. My colleague, Mrs. Wise, was, I think, a little afraid of her. Well, I liked her enormously. I didn't adore her. But I admired her tremendously.
Yeah. Yeah.
I thought she was a grand person.
Yeah.
And in some ways, and you know, this sounds ridiculous, must sound, and it probably isn't true, I mean, this may be a figment of my imagination. In some ways, I felt very close to Ray Strachey. I felt that there were streaks in her that were very like streaks in me, and so I could understand a lot of the things she did.
I was wondering, actually, that you remember you described a rather extraordinary way in which you were recruited by Ray Strachey,
yes.
Saying, you know...
Do you mind what you do?
Yes, well, yes, and that sort of thing. Was that typical of the sort of rather informal, unexpected way in which she'd approach people?
Yes, I think she was a person who took incredibly quick decisions. And I think she had a sort of almost second sight about people. I don't think she was just carried along by her enthusiasms. I think she knew instinctively who the people were who were likely to be useful to her in some of the ways she wanted them to be useful. She certainly spotted about me the first time she met me that I wasn't ambitious. I wasn't primarily concerned with a career. She knew, probably because I told her, she asked me a lot of questions at that interview. She asked me whether I was interested in the women's movement, and I said, well, I was brought up in it, more or less.
Mm.
But I think she knew, well, here was someone who'd fit in.
Mm. Mm.
And in that sense, I felt quite close to her.
But was she, in a way, rather swashbuckling in
no.
her approach to human nature? I mean,
not
was bit. She was she sort of did she approach people in a very informal way like that and say unexpected things and
she said unexpected things, but I never saw her other than courteous and polite.
Mm.
She was friendly and open in the way that Americans can be without being offensive. There was something about her that was very American. She probably wouldn't like that, but there was, you know? The kind of thing I mean, a great friend of mine was the principal of Vassar, Sarah Blanding. And Sarah Blanding came to visit us in the country, in Dorchester, years ago, and I shared the bigger house with my friends. And she'd been given an introduction to us by someone we knew very well, Edith Stedman from Radcliffe. And she knocked at the door, and I happened to open it to her. And in strode this tall, rather elegant Southern American. She was very much of the South. And firmly kissed me and said, I'm Sarah Blanding from Vassar. I kiss at the drop of a hat. And that's just the beginning of a great friendship, because I don't kiss at the drop of a hat. But it was irresistible, you see, quite
yeah.
irresistible.
Yeah.
From that point on, you know, we were just friends.
And she had this sort of openness as well.
Well, Ray had it too. She didn't do that sort of thing, because Sarah Blanding wasn't shy.
Mm,
and I think
Ray
in
was.
A funny way, Ray Strachey was shy.
Yeah.
But I'd love to know whether her daughter thinks she was.
Mm.
Because a lot of people wouldn't agree with me about that, but I think she had an inner shyness that had nothing to do with her extrovert
Well, she said, her daughter certainly said, I think, that she didn't, for instance, naturally embrace people. She withdrew always.
Yes.
She didn't feel comfortable, even with her own children, kissing them or embracing them.
No, no. I'm quite sure that she was... essentially a private person with a very good facade of being a very public person.
Yes, again, just like, well, not like Eleanor particularly, but like Eva Hubbock, who we were discussing yesterday as well. I went to see, I'll switch myself off. There's something rather interesting in what, it seemed to me that it's a rather interesting combination, WEF, actually, of sort of charitable body and a sort of self-supporting, income-raising body.
Yes.
And that fits Ray's personality.
Well,
she doesn't want to be involved in charity. She doesn't want to be involved in fundraising and being dependent
she
on...
She certainly didn't want to be involved in fundraising. She hated to beg for money, and yet she did it all the time. the thing she believed in. But she thought that an organisation that was worth its salt ought to be self-maintaining. She thought we ought to be able to earn enough money to see us through by our own efforts. And she believed very firmly in charging a modest fee to people who could afford to pay it, and seeing people who couldn't afford to pay it for nothing. So that at least a third of our work always was charitable. And of course, because I don't think she was awfully interested in money for herself, I don't know whether she had a lot or hadn't. I mean,
not a lot. She depended on her mother to a large extent.
Well, yes. But how rich was Benson?
Oh, quite well off, though less well off by the late 30s than he had been earlier.
Was
she?
Was
getting money from her mother earlier on in her life, and quite regularly.
Was she?
Yeah.
That I didn't know. She was very fond of her mother. That I did know, because she talked to me about her at one time.
Did she really?
Yes.
Because again, I mean, the fondness is equivocal. I mean, her mother's a very intrusive woman. I mean, always trying to interfere in her life. This is part of Ray's privacy, as far as I can understand.
Yes,
it.
That I didn't know.
Trying to fight off.
I know
mother.
The mother's history, the public history.
Yes.
In many ways, I thought of her as being a little like Frieda Lawrence, whom I knew quite well. I don't know whether they are alike.
What
I mean,
aspect?
I never saw
Mrs.
Benson.
Yes.
But Frieda Lawrence was like a bulldozer wanting to interfere in her children's life until, of course, she met Lawrence, and then he carted her off, and her husband, Professor Wheatley, didn't allow her to see her children until they were entirely grown up. And then Barbara, who was the one I knew best, broke loose and went over and lived with them for a time, and is really the inspiration of the Virgin and the Gypsy.
Mm. Is she really?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
They were all, in the end, linked up with their mother again. But she was a very dominant person. She was a Richthofen, you probably know.
Mm.
And I think she was actually the sister, not the cousin of the German war, Ace Richthofen.
But if you're seeking...
Mrs. Berenson I never met.
Mm.
I once saw a photograph of her, but I can't remember what it looked like. Mm. But Ray talked to me about her when I'd been there some years, on the occasion when she got this terrible kidney infection, a nephritis. And the drugs for dealing with it had just been discovered at the
her
time.
Her mother got it.
Yes, her mother got
it. I didn't know she had
that. Ray thought it was the end at the time. She thought she was going out to see her mother, who was probably dying. Of course, the mother didn't die, and I think it was antibiotics that saved her. And she talked a little about her mother then, and said that she lived in Italy, and she had married Mr. Berenson. Whether they ever were actually married or not, I don't know. I don't think they were they?
They were, I think, yes, in the end, yes.
But... she didn't say much more, but she was deeply worried about this infection and clearly very much moved at the idea of her mother dying.
Mm.
And so, there may have been a kind of love-hate relationship between them.
Well, there was, as far as I understand, this is what you asked me about.
She felt that I ought to see America, and I think she was quite right, and of course I did see America. I know America quite well now. But at that time, I had just left Oxford. I was living with my mother in London. I wanted to live with my mother in London, which was why I had moved. And I think Ray thought that there was a certain weakness in me wanting to continue living with my mother,
Yes, I see, yes, yes.
But my mother and I were very good friends. We had a lot of fun together.
Mm.
And both my parents, and I was very blessed in this, had the capacity to let people go. Mm. I told you, I think, before, it was my father who pushed me away from home when I was offered a job in which I could have stayed at home.
You see, her mother didn't do that at all. Her mother, I mean, it was being in Italy that saved Ray.
So in that sense, my parents never lost me in that there were no restricting influences. They were just a wall at my back, and I rushed home to them whenever I got the chance.
But getting back to the fund business, I mean, I wonder how far Ray really wanted it to be, WEF to be independent of voluntary gifts. Partly because she so hated doing it this way. I suppose part of it is just that if you do become self-supporting, that's a testimony that you're useful.
She wanted the organisation to earn its own way. I think she was sometimes a little blind, as people with private means can be, as to how difficult it was for many of her helpers who were really trying to live on what they earned, because she didn't have to worry about that.
Mm.
And so I think she saw, again, this may be an unfair judgment, it's difficult to know, but I think that she saw nothing incompatible in saying, this organization is marvelously independent and self-supporting while paying the staff much less than they should have been paid.
I understand.
And I think that this is a very, I'm not saying this in a critical sense, because this was
it's a
very
human
common point of view for people who've never had to worry about where the next penny comes from.
Mm. Of course, she's dependent also on quite a lot of voluntary labour,
yes,
as well as badly paid labour.
I mean, I don't think for a moment she realised that when I left Oxford, I was actually living and making do, because I didn't want, my mother had a small pension, I would have liked to help her, and the fact that we shared a house in London certainly made it easier, but that was my wish, not hers. She said, do what you want to do, be entirely free, and she meant it. But I was living on 200 a year, and I don't suppose, you know, Ray would have thought of that at all.
No.
I didn't mind. I mean, I did it with my eyes open, because I wanted to do it, and I knew how.
Mm.
But it's very difficult, I think, to see the point of view of people who are living on what they earn when your mind is full of causes.
There's a similar contradiction with Pippa as well. I mean, they're both in the paradoxical situation because they've got leisure and money to some extent.
Yes.
They can organise these movements, but organising these movements requires them to really understand what the situation of ordinary people is, and there are limits as to how far they can ever do that.
I think that's always true in a way, you know.
I mean, it's a difficult situation.
It's very difficult, because neither of them were without a very large share of the milk of human kindness.
Mm.
And also, both of them, I think, were more or less indifferent to creature comforts. See, Ray, who could have been very attractive to look at, didn't care how she dressed, and usually dressed in the wrong way for her size and shape. Pippa, whom this book says had an interest in clothes, in fact some of her letters concern clothes, but she had no clothes sense. And, of course, Philippa Fawcett, if you'd met her in the street, you'd have probably felt you must look in your purse and give her sixpence.
She was still around, was she by
the time
you were...
She was still around in 1936.
Yeah,
I met her on a number of occasions. The first time I saw her, I didn't know who she was and thought, oh, that poor woman who's deranged. She looked deranged. She was totally oblivious of what was going on round her with this very fine mathematical mind.
Was she really?
Yes.
Because she was a key figure in the LSWS much earlier
on.
Oh,
yes. And where causes were concerned, she was very much on the ball. She certainly wasn't deranged.
No.
But the kind of thing she would do, because she was getting on in years then, being, I think, quite well-to-do, not lacking for money at all, she would walk carrying heavy suitcases rather than ever take a taxi. She had this idea that any form of personal indulgence was a sin.
Mm. Mm.
And I think there was abnormality there, and not in the sense of madness, but...
eccentricity, anyway.
Yes, she was unclubbable, I would have said, really, like a very brilliant old...
It's interesting, because, I mean, obviously the succession could easily have been that she should take the place that Pippa later took.
You see, Mrs. Fawcett herself, Millicent, whom I missed, I didn't meet, but I knew about her from my father.
Mm.
She, I believe, had great charm and very much on the ball. And Henry Fawcett himself must have been a most attractive man.
Mm.
But their one daughter was, I think, an oddity.
Yes, yes. She was in the LCC, wasn't she, in the education department?
Yes, in the end.
But
She wasn't the first person to get into major employment in government or local government service. Elizabeth Ahrens was that, whom I knew quite well.
How do you spell that?
A-H-R-O-N-S.
Oh, yes.
And after the passing of the Sex Disqualification Removal Act, which was, what, 1919, I think in 21 or 22, and I can't be sure which date, Elizabeth Ahrens passed into the administrative grade in the civil service and was in the Department of Education. She was a Cambridge graduate too. And she was a most delightful and amusing person. There are some letters from her.
Yes, I know.
Did you come across her?
Yes.
Well, I knew her very well.
Yeah.
She wrote to me when I became Deputy Organising Secretary to say how pleased she was and kept in touch with us until her death.
It seemed to me from what, the way you talk about Ray that she's quite different from Eleanor Rathbone in this sense that
Oh yes, quite different.
She could mobilise her staff partly by using personal arts in the sense that she would confide in them, she'd talk to them about her personal affairs, and she would be a companion as much as a boss, if you see what I mean.
Yes, she was never the heavy boss, never under any circumstances. And she would, you know, put her head round the door of an office and say, isn't this marvellous news? You know, the Carnegie have given us £1,000. She'd share the good things with her staff. Mm-hmm. And she had the ability to make people feel they were part of a team. Though she was, in fact,
people,
yes, very much in command. In one sense, and I hope you won't put this in as a quote from me ever, because it would give a quite wrong impression from what I want to convey. I don't know how else to put it. In a nice and not a nasty sense, she was a manipulator.
Yes. She knew what was desirable.
She knew how to get the results she needed and wanted to the things she believed in. I don't think she ever did it for herself. And in that sense, I would say she was without self-interest.
Yes,
but for the things she believed in, the things she thought were right, either for people or for causes, she would go to almost any lengths.
In other words, you're saying she's a practical woman.
Oh, yes. She was practical. She was practical with her hands, too, as you know.
Yes.
She built things and did things.
Yes. But, I mean, you've got to have this sort of quality to get anything done in life, haven't you, really?
Now, Pippa hadn't got that, really. Pippa was, in spite of the fact that she wasn't an academic and was, she would say, the least well-educated of her family, she was a real intellectual, I think.
Mm.
She never talked about it, mercifully. But,
oh yes, I mean she was very learned among other things.
Extremely learned and extremely cultured. And if you think of the set she knew, I mean, even the Bloomsbury group, lamentable as they were in many ways, must have been enthralling. I mean, I'm really very glad that both my age and my circumstances and geography prevented me from ever having any contact with a group of that kind, because I think in some ways they were fundamentally disreputable and phony.
Yes, corrupting.
Yes. But I think that if I'd met them in my late teens, I would have been sunk. Absolutely.
Actually, another thing which
much more maternal
about
her causes.
That's quite
Wet was her baby, much more than either Christopher or Barbara.
Yes, I think that's
that was my impression when I.
But this personal willingness to talk easily to her staff and so on in Wet, did that extend to Mrs. Wise and the other employees, or was it just for you? I mean,
I'm sure she talked to Margaret Baines.
Yes.
She talked to me. I don't think she talked much to Mrs. Wise, because Mrs. Wise, although she admired her and valued her as I did, was a quite different kettle of fish.
I see, yes.
She was a clever woman, utterly devoted to her children, you know, the perfect mother hen in a way. I remember once, this is typical of Dorothy Wise, who became a great friend of mine, and her daughter, incidentally, is the wife of the clergyman at St. Michael's and All Angels, and I was, you know, present at their wedding over the way. I don't see Margaret very much these days. You know, our lives have gone along quite different lines. But I remember once during the war, there was half a bottle of milk left over in the office, and there were a lot of cats about, and the whole place had been bombed. Then we were in Cromwell Place. And I had a saucer, and I said, I'm going to put this milk out on the roof. The cats will eat it. She said, I think it's perfectly sinful of you to put milk out for cats when there are children starving all over Europe. So I said, take the bottle of milk, Dorothy, and give it to the European starving children. By tomorrow morning it will be sour and no good to the children or you or to me or anyone else. Do you know a child would drink it? Of course she didn't.
But she was not an easygoing person in a way then.
Dorothy, oh no, she was very easygoing, very pleasant, very easygoing, very motherly. But, you know, the perfect mother, my children come first.
Yes,
I mean, she would have sacrificed everything.